Good afternoon, everyone. It's always good to see you all. Grateful that you invite us from time to time to spend some time with you and share some thoughts. There are many unavoidable and inescapable realities of this life that I often find myself lamenting. For instance, if it were up to me, there would be no 60-plus hour work weeks. There probably would be no 40-hour work weeks. There would be no lawnmowers because the grass wouldn't just grow and grow and grow, and the weeds grow even faster. There would be no birthdays because kids wouldn't grow up and leave the home. There would be no car repair shops or home improvement stores because things wouldn't break at the most inopportune times. There would be no hospitals because no one would get sick or injured or suffer from disease or illness. There would be no militaries because wars and conflicts would not exist. There would be no struggles over borders or the threat against them. And there would be no funeral homes or cemeteries because we would not take our loved ones there to lay them to rest. And yet, in many ways, and in many situations, I find myself extremely grateful and relieved by these very same things. So thankfully, our wise and almighty Father has not entrusted such things to my puny perspective and to my foolish and selfish discretion and whims, because each of these things has their rightfully appointed purpose and place. As Solomon famously writes in the opening verses of Ecclesiastes 3, to everything there is a season, and a time for every purpose under heaven, among which there is a time to be born and a time to die. There is a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time of war and a time of peace. And not only does each one of these things have its proper time and place, but Solomon goes so far in this passage to proclaim that God has made everything beautiful in its time. In verse 11, I have to confess to you today that I often struggle to concur with this truth. I often struggle to see the beauty in many of these experiences as they unfold all around me, as they begin to impact my life and the life of those I love, and especially when these things don't seem to fit within my own timing and they upset the concept that I have for what is best in my life. And one of the specific experiences or realities that I often find myself grappling with is the subject I'd like to ponder for just a few minutes with you this afternoon, and that is the concept of weakness. The concept of weakness. While the term weakness isn't explicitly mentioned there in Ecclesiastes 3, I believe that it is very much implied and inherent in much of what is described and outlined throughout. Weakness in some form or fashion seems to be at the very core of what is either being utilized and exploited to tear down, to bring low, or it's the condition that is being overcome, to build up, to establish, to settle. But in either case, its present and its potential is very much reality. It's there, and it seems to be something that's inescapable. Since we're all exposed to and subject to weakness, I'm confident that we all have at least a basic, practical, working understanding of what weakness is. But weakness, by definition, is something that it yields. It's something that fails. It's something that gives way. It recedes. It is soft. It is not able to bear up under load. It is, by definition, the opposite of strength. It has little strength or power. It is feeble. It is easily broken. And this condition manifests itself in our lives in a wide variety of forms and fashions. It can come in physical defects and deficiencies. We see it in the limitations of our bodies. It might come through our frailty of mind, from something as benign as mere forgetfulness, all the way to unhealthy and broken attitudes and thought processes. We might see it in our power of providence and prerogative to control all the surrounding aspects of our life and quickly realize that we cannot. Or we might see it in our failure of courage and heart and resolve cave in to those things which we know we should not, ungodly and sinful desires. But whatever form or fashion that this human weakness reveals itself to us, it often creates an environment or feeling of vulnerability. It makes us feel uncertain. It makes us have a lack of confidence. We're fearful, even to the point sometimes of becoming distraught or discouraged. Sometimes these weaknesses may seem like very minor, pesky annoyances, and other times they bring us to our knees and they completely cripple and disable certain aspects of our lives and being. But whatever the case, the reality remains that none of us can and none of us will go through life unaffected, unscathed, or untouched by weakness. It's simply a part of the human existence. And yet, while we might not have the choice as to whether we will face or experience weakness, we all have the choice as to how we are going to respond to it, and even, I believe, how we might utilize it. Whether these weaknesses are the result of our own foolish choices or decisions or circumstances that are completely outside of our control, weakness is an ever-present reality, and it too, I do believe, has its time and place and purpose. As I've reflected on this topic recently, it struck me that, like many of those things that I confessed to you a moment ago that I often struggle with, they often grieve me, my problem seems to not be rooted so much in the presence of weakness, but in a faulty perception and appreciation of it. My problem is that I often fail to give weakness its rightful place in my life and its rightful time. I fail to see, dare I say, the beauty in weakness, whether it be my own or maybe even the weakness of those around me. My natural reaction when I see or experience weakness is often one of frustration. It's something that troubles me. It is unpleasant to realize and to recognize. It's undesirable to me. Many times it's something that discourages me. It's something I find myself spending an awful lot of time and energy trying to conceal or trying to ignore or trying to avoid. And I wrestle with trying to find a reason for it, to make sense of why it's there. And I don't think I'm by any means alone in this regard. Job was a man that was crushed and afflicted in ways that many of us cannot comprehend, much less relate to. Almost overnight, his wealth, what would have comprised much of his physical security, was stripped away. All of his beloved children were taken from him. His support structure, what should have been his support structure, and his wife and friends became a source of conflict and grief and sorrow. His mind and body became a conduit of constant agony, something that he could not escape from. And all these things together made Job question God why. He struggled to make sense of his experiences. He felt like he was all alone, like there was really no point to his very existence. Not only did he wish he was dead, but he wished he had never been born. He wondered what could possibly be the purpose of what he was going through. Had his Creator forgotten that his strength was so small, that his days were but a mere breath, that his strength was not the strength of stones or his flesh bronze, that he had been, in fact, made and formed like clay, something that was very delicate and fragile? Those are the things that were going through Job's mind as he was dealing with encountering weakness. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul pulls back the curtain a little bit on his own infirmities and what he calls his thorn of the flesh there, something that he attributed at least to be a messenger of Satan. And from his immediate perspective, he struggled to find the benefit in it. He likely saw it as a hindrance to what otherwise could have been more work, more productive work for the Lord. And as a result, he pleads with the Lord there three times to take it away. Get rid of this, a request that was denied each time. So we see that even for these good, upright, godly men, the presence and experience of weakness was something that they struggled to understand and to process. And this seems to be a consistent truth or theme of all mankind and creation from the very beginning. When God looked out over his magnificent creation, in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31, a creation that at that time was free of sin and offense. He declared that it was very good. Was God confirming that he saw no sign or trace of weakness? Was he affirming that every aspect of his creation possessed the same relative measure of perfect strength, that it was fully self-sufficient, that it was unbreakable, that it was unyielding in nature? Well, I'm convinced that he was not. If he was, if that was his intent, then it seems somewhat strange and inconsistent to me, at least, that he created a greater light to rule the day and a lesser light to rule the night. He designed animals and human beings to procreate in ways that the mature gave birth to something that was weak, that was fragile, it was immature. He made vegetation to go to seed, at the end of its life cycle, and it would yield very tender plants which would spring up from the ground, something that was easily broken. He gave man dominion and power over all living things that move on the earth. I think that God's very creation reveals that not every element possesses the same degree of glory or strength, and yet they all fit together and work together perfectly. It was indeed very good. God's establishment of relationships and ordained authority also display varying levels of power and strength, not in any kind of disparaging way, as many would like us to believe, but in a very beautiful way. God made a way and established authority in a way that bred order, it bred purpose, responsibility, protection, all very healthy and necessary things. God made woman, the weaker vessel, as she's called in 1 Peter 3 and 7, to be a key helper and become an invaluable and necessary part of man, without which he was not considered complete. He was deficient. Imagine a world where these weaker elements didn't exist. I wouldn't want to go through life that way. Imagine a world where these distinctions had not been made, where the weaker did not yield and give way to the strong, or the strong did not accept, acknowledge, and honor to protect the weaker. It would be absolutely a miserable and confusing anarchy. Constant turmoil, constant conflict, and total chaos. And unfortunately, we don't have to rely on our imagination to see the destructive consequences that result in failing to recognize and failing to honor these God-given distinctions in the perfect, for the purpose and place of weakness. Satan refused to accept his lesser place before the Lord and pridefully rebelled. Adam abandoned and neglected his responsibility of headship and authority to protect the woman from spiritual attack. Eve was deceived by the same false promise of empowerment and wisdom and strength that she came to believe were rightfully hers and were being withheld from her, reaching out to partake of that fruit and giving the man the same. It simply didn't take long for a warped perspective of weakness to bring a curse upon and wreak havoc on God's wonderful creation. And at the very root, at the very heart of mankind's fall was a failure to properly appreciate and to properly respond to weakness. They didn't want it. They didn't understand it. They certainly didn't honor it. And unlike what many would have us to believe today, mankind on its own has not developed beyond, we have not evolved beyond or strengthened ourselves against these very same struggles and these very same failures and these very same tendencies. We still often struggle to adopt and embrace a healthy and accurate and productive view of weakness. It's often talked about and viewed in a way that is strictly negative, it is unflattering, it is unsavory. We're bombarded by what are meant to be encouraging and empowering slogans, such as show no weakness, something that has to be concealed. Don't let anyone see. You're only as strong as your weakest link, which implies you shouldn't have one. If you're tired of a weakness, then make it a strength. Just work on it enough and you'll make it a strength. All these are probably well-meaning, but I think often misguided pieces of advice on how to view and deal with weakness. We've probably already all sat through those extraordinarily awkward job interviews where your prospective employer sits you down on the other side of the table and they ask you to list three of your greatest strengths and three of your greatest weaknesses. And if you're like me, you know, those strengths pop out just rapid fire, one after the other. And then you're left to squirm around and contort until you can somehow present three weaknesses in such a light that they're actually somehow valuable and productive and even desirable. You know, my greatest strength is, you know, sometimes I just work too hard, you know, something like that. We've all been there. But that's, I don't believe, the perspective that Scripture instructs us to adopt of our weaknesses. It's not something that must always be dismissed or compensated for or altogether avoided. Rather, it seems to me that weakness is often an underrated and underappreciated quality and condition. While Satan often attempts to exploit our weaknesses to discourage, to manipulate, to destroy, that is not God's purpose or intent or goal in making us the way that he did. Answering one of Job's questions that we referred to a moment ago, David writes in Psalm 103 and 14, I'll start in verse 13, he writes, "As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust." God knows. God understands what we are and are not capable of. As our very Creator, God understands our weaknesses better than we do. He made us the way he made us, and I believe that he had a reason for it, and there is a purpose. As it goes on to say later in this same psalm, his desire is that we fear him, that we remember him, that we cling to him and to his commandments, and that we do them, because that's what's best for us. He pities us, and he has compassion for us, and maybe that's why he allows us to face the weaknesses that we do. I hope that no one takes my thoughts here this afternoon the wrong way. I feel like I need to put a little bit of a caveat on this. There is no disputing that there are certainly weaknesses that we all must be aware of, that we are expected to overcome and move beyond. There is a time to be strengthened. There's a time to be built up. There's a time to mature. The author of Hebrews seems to have been writing to a group that needed encouragement to grow up, and to move on, and to develop. He writes in chapter 5, verses 12 through 14 of that book, he points out that they should have matured beyond what they had. Later in chapter 12, he encourages them to use God's training and his discipline, his chastening, to become strengthened rather than discouraged and despondent and dislocated. But once again, this seems to highlight the importance of how we view and how we respond to weakness when it's encountered in our lives. Deal with it with what God has given us and the provisions he's made for us. What is often perceived as an undesirable and discouraging weakness may very well have an important purpose and come with a number of critical benefits if we view it and use it properly. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul writes, the weakness is a key part of God's plan. He says in verse 18 of that chapter, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." What seems to be the picture of weakness and a suffering Savior is actually one of great power. Picking back up in verse 27 of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he writes, "God has chosen the foolish things of this world to put to shame the wise, the weak things of this world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things which are." And what's the purpose for all this? He goes on to say that no flesh should glory in his presence. That no flesh should glory in his presence. Weakness, I believe, guards and protects us from ourselves, from becoming conceited, from becoming prideful, from thinking that we stand on our own just to set ourselves up for a great fall, to keep us and guard us from relying on something that is frail and that is flimsy, something that was not designed to support certain loads. And God knows that. God made us that way. Paul recognized this very purpose for his own weakness in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that we referenced a little while ago. He says, "Lest I should be exalted above measure, it was given to me." Lest I should be exalted above measure. Now that might not have been Satan's goal, if he did in fact send that as a messenger, but that does seem to be God's purpose. And what was God's perspective on what Paul was going through? Well, he says, his response is, "My grace is sufficient for you, For my strength is made perfect in weakness. Strength is made perfect in weakness. And as a result, Paul goes on to conclude there that he would gladly rather boast in his infirmities, that the power of Christ may dwell on me. Weakness can be the very catalyst, I believe, that compels us to remove our focus from ourselves and to place it where it really belongs, on the Lord and on those around us, to seek the true strength, the true power from the right source, power that comes from the Lord. It's often the means and instrument that God uses to display His power toward those who love Him, because oftentimes it's weakness that we first begin to look to Him in the first place and acknowledge that we need Him. Paul makes a comment in 2 Corinthians 4 and 7. He's talking there about his own ministry that has been given to him, the word that's been entrusted to him to show and share with the Gentiles. And he says that we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. He acknowledged the benefit of having weakness and having this great gift, the message of the gospel, so that everyone that knows and heard from him would know that the power really was from God and not of us. Many of those we're called to look to as an inspiring examples of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 demonstrated that faith by enduring circumstances of apparent weakness. In fact, in Hebrews 11, verses 33 through 34, it speaks of those who, through faith, experienced some mighty feats of strength. It talks about them subduing kingdoms, working righteousness, obtaining promises, stopping the mouths of lions, quenching the violence of fire, escaping the edge of the sword, all great and mighty things, but not because they were mighty in and of themselves. It says, out of weakness they were made strong. Out of weakness they were made strong. Would that have been the same outcome or result if they had become dejected and discouraged by observing the weaknesses that they had dealt with? If they had gotten tired of waiting on the Lord and tried to go it alone, relying on their own power and strength? Well, the answer is obviously a resounding and definitive no. It would not have been the same result. These passages and many others like it teach us that there is indeed a time and a place for weakness that can and should have a beautiful result. On a personal level, weakness can be the very agent that helps us humbly remain grounded in our proper place, a place of safety and protection under the wing of a loving and merciful Father. And it can prompt us to place our trust and reliance where it really belongs, on the Lord who made us and knows what is best for us, who will lift us up if we will humble ourselves before Him. However, it seems that the benefits of our perceived and even real weaknesses may extend even beyond those that we recognize on a personal or internal level. I won't take the time to read it, but Paul writes about the church in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and he describes it there, a manner in which the Lord has designed and organized that church. It's an entity that is pictured and illustrated in that passage as a body. It's composed of many different members. It's an organism comprised of a structure that the Lord Himself has designed and composed, one that He Himself is a member of, being the very head. He has set each member in the body just as He pleases. Each part has its proper and appointed place and function. And while each member may not have or seem to have the same strength as those around them, it says in verse 22 that they are all necessary. Some versions say they are indispensable, even those that appear to be weak. And as I read that passage in context of the topic we're talking about this afternoon, the beauty of the body really struck me in a way that it had not before. Not only is it arranged in such a way to provide aid, to provide comfort, to provide healing and reinforcement to those that need it, to help share, to help bear burdens, but it also occurred to me that it may just be that the presence of an apparent weakness may be exactly what is needed for the good of the whole. I'm typically not a big fan of discussing my job, especially from the pulpit, but I'm going to make a small exception here. I was talking with Paul a little bit before services about what I do. Spent the better part of the last 12 years as a structural engineer, designing mainly concrete and steel structures. And in my profession as a structural engineer, weakness is generally something that we're strongly encouraged to avoid, as you might understand. It's something that we try to design out of structures. For obvious reasons, a structural element that is weak, one that is easily broken, one that yields and deforms, one that is not able to bear up under loads, is concerning, and it typically is considered undesirable. If you've ever had the experience of walking into a building and seeing a member or a beam or a column that was obviously experiencing some distress, maybe it was bowed or bent or twisted or buccaled in some way, that's a disconcerting feeling. And I know I've been there myself. And it may even render a portion of that structure temporarily unusable or unserviceable. You might have to shut it down for a while. But based on my experience, these are generally not the kinds of weaknesses that lead to catastrophic, life-threatening failures that are splashed all over the front page of the newspaper. The old adage or the old joke of structural engineering, when in doubt, make it stout, does not always produce the safer, most fail-proof structure that is intended. And unfortunately, this is a lesson that our industry has had to learn the hard way from time to time in the past. On January 17th, 1994, a magnitude 6.7 earthquake, we commonly refer to it as the Northridge earthquake, struck the San Fernando Valley area. Being only 8 years old at the time, I don't really recall much from that news coverage surrounding the actual event, and I'm sure many in this room have a much more clear and vivid memory of that event than I do. But what I have read of this earthquake and its effects, I find both fascinating and very sobering. While the primary shockwave only lasted about 10 to 20 seconds, it resulted in one of the most destructive and costly national disasters in United States history. It killed 57, it injured more than 8,700, and it caused property damage estimated between $13 and $50 billion. Unsurprisingly, over the years, as a result of that disaster and the lessons learned from it, many initiatives have been kicked off. There have been changes and advancements to building codes, the way that these structures are designed that could potentially be subject to earthquake loads. And without boring everyone with a bunch of technical details or theory, one of the takeaways from Northridge that and other events like it was the need to review and improve on some of the member and connection design of high seismic areas. I don't want to stand up here and act like I'm any kind of expert on the subject. I am not. But one thing that I found very interesting was there was an emphasis and an importance placed on purposefully creating a relatively weak element or connection in such structures, one that is specifically designed to yield. It is specifically designed to deform, to move, to absorb energy that would otherwise be transfer very large destructive loads in the structure to members that might not be designed for it, but members that are absolutely critical to the overall integrity of the structure. In essence, it's similar to incorporating a fuse in a system. You're preventing a catastrophic failure of the surrounding components in the system as a whole. Where a very rigid member or connection would tend to bow up against these loads, resulting in a very sudden, a very brittle failure, what we call fracture, this weaker element would be able to move. It would be able to deform. It would be able to absorb that energy, and it would protect those around them. It would protect those around them. And while this member may very well yield, it might deform, it might even need to be replaced or repaired or reinforced after this event, it helps to preserve the overall integrity of the structure as a whole, and it helps to hold everything together. It holds everything together. And I couldn't help but think of this concept as I was reading through this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. The Lord has arranged and composed a very beautiful and a very effective body, and it has all kinds of different members, all different types, with different functions. even some that may outwardly at times appear to be weak. It might appear to be unstable. They might even seem to be a liability, but it may just be that those are the ones that are absolutely necessary and critical for the well-being of the whole. The intent, as described in this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, is that there is no schism. There's no fracture. There's no division in the body. That all the members stay together and hold together and care for one another. And sometimes that means yielding for the greater good. Sometimes that means yielding. We may be tempted to become frustrated with our perception that certain joints aren't supplying what we think they should. They're not doing their share. They're not supplying enough. But maybe it's the one that is willing and able to yield, as we read about in James 3 and 17, where others cannot or will not. Helping to keep the body knit and joined together as intended, like we see in Ephesians 4 and 16. Maybe that is it doing its share. And I'm grateful for the strength that the Lord has instilled and arranged for in that body, because far too often I am not willing, to my shame. Jesus is the very head of the body, as the preeminent part, as the one that controls the rest, is an absolutely beautiful example of how God uses something that probably from the outside appears very weak, very fragile, something that can be so easily broken and torn down and destroyed to achieve unbelievably powerful results. What if he had not been willing to humble himself and take on weakness that was found in the form of a man, even though he was found in the very form of God? Philippians chapter 2. What if Jesus was unyielding in this regard? What if he was above being broken or crushed for transgressions that were not his? Well, would we have the same hope that this body that is sown in weakness and corruption could be raised in power, incorruptible and full of glory at his coming? I think we all know the answer to that question. So the question that comes to my mind, if that was Jesus' attitude and mindset, then what should mine be? What should mine be? If you're outside of the Lord Jesus Christ today, then you are truly in a very weak and in a very vulnerable position, and one that we cannot fix on our own. But if you're willing to come to him with a broken and with a contrite heart, it is one that God will not refuse or despise. If you are ready to repent, to confess him, to accept his invitation, to obey the gospel and be baptized, to put to death the old man, to be raised to walk in newness of life, then you will find true strength in the Lord. We read it just a moment ago in Romans chapter 5, verse 6. For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. Jesus Christ knows our weaknesses and needs better than we do. He experienced them in every way, and he was yet perfect for a sacrifice for us. And he offers us not only rest, but he offers us help to pull our loads. Last thing I'll mention before we close is what Jesus himself extends and offers us as invitation in Matthew chapter 11, starting in verse 28. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Jesus offers us rest, and he offers us a yoke that we were made to carry. And it is one that is yoked with him, pulling in the same direction, in the right direction, for the Lord. That is real power. And if that's your desire, to be yoked together with Jesus, then please make that known and accept the gospel as we stand and sing.